Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the program. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another episode of The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. Well, today I'm sitting down one-on-two. My guests have jointly published a new book, Rogue Town. It is an absolutely fascinating look at how rife corruption was in Stamford, Connecticut in the 1970s. It is my great pleasure to welcome Denny Griffin and Vito Colucci. Hello, gentlemen.
Thank you, Simon, very much.
Thank you, Simon. Been a while, and I'm glad to be back on one of your shows.
You'll notice I called you gentleman. It was a slip of the tongue. Vito, I believe we have talked before on a mob-related program, but really I didn't know much about you. All I knew is that you were a private investigator, but there's much more to the story of Vito Colucci, as Rogue Town reveals. Would you care to give us a quick lowdown on who Vito Colucci is?
Well, originally born and raised in Stamford, Connecticut, where I lived for 65 years of my life. Just now live the last several months out in Henderson, Nevada, with many trips back east. And at age 21, I joined the Stamford Police Department. I worked during my time on the job. I worked as a narcotics detective. I worked undercover organized crime against my own bosses and the two mobs in town at the time. And met up with Denny, and after Denny tells you a little something, he'll tell you how we actually met, you know? I mean, putting a gun to somebody always helps to have them write your book, you know? But he had a gun himself, so it was kind of a standoff. But
right, you know what a great way to break the ice at parties. Just pull out a gun.
Yeah.
And Denny, I know you quite well, but for the sake of our listeners, why don't you explain a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I was born and raised back east also in Rome, New York. That's upstate, right about between Utica and Syracuse. And I was there. I finished 20 years in law enforcement and investigations. I retired in 1994, and my wife and I became snowbirds. We do Las Vegas in the winters and go back to upstate New York for the summers. And after... I was a little bored initially. I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself after I retired, so I decided I would take up the hobby of writing. And that was in 1994, and I'm still plugging away at it. So it turned out to be quite a hobby, and I'm having a very good time with my writing. I started out with fiction. Now I'm into true crime and primarily organized crime.
Right. And you know, we've had this discussion before. You didn't do so hot with the fiction side, but you really seem to have found your groove with the factual true crime books.
Very true, Simon. The fiction, first of all, it's a very tough genre because there's some great fiction mystery thriller writers. It's really tough, at least it was for me, to break into the upper echelon. And I was going to give it up until I met one of the speakers at a writer's conference, and we talked, and she said, well, with your background, why don't you get into writing nonfiction police-related stuff? And, you know, I got thinking it over, and it made sense, and she gave me a hand in how to submit a proposal to my local police agency out here in Vegas, it's Las Vegas Metro, to do their history, write their history, and I did that. They accepted the proposal. I worked with Metro as far as them endorsing the project and assigning a person to work with me to make sure I got accurate information and so on. And through that, I did an article, a piece in that book about Tony Spilotro, which led to another book, and then that in turn led to a book about Frank Collada. So it was kind of a domino effect. And the thing about it is I really enjoy doing the research because I enjoy talking to these retired mobsters and retired cops and FBI agents and so forth. So it's become a lot of fun for me.
I guess, you know, a question that I've had, I have spoken to Vito at least once before. But how did you and Vito get to know each other? And I'll just bet there's a mob connection.
As a matter of fact, there's a crime and a mob connection. I was, as you probably were, I have a show called Crime Wire on Blog Talk Radio. We've been doing it for several years now. And we profile unsolved homicide and suspicious death cases. And also, I do organized crime. And on one of the shows, Vito joined not only in the chat room, but called in. And we became acquainted through that phone call and that show, and we corresponded back and forth. And then became friends as a result of that. And what was it, Vito, about 2 years ago or so, we talked about writing Rogue Town.
Right.
And I was interested in the project because it sounded like an excellent story. Although I got to tell you, Simon, at first, when he first told me, I'm thinking Stamford, Connecticut. You know, I mean, I'm used to hearing this, you know, New York City, Chicago, Detroit, Miami. But I didn't really associate organized crime, a heavy organized crime presence with Stamford. But then as I got thinking about it and Vito started explaining to me how with the setup, I said, my God, that makes sense. It's, you know, almost a suburb of New York City. I mean, close to New York City, there's a lot of interaction between the two places and so on. I said, what a perfect setup for organized crime. So then it made a whole lot of sense to me, and I was glad to get involved with the book.
I have to admit that, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not originally from the U.S. I didn't actually cross the pond until 1980, and I certainly didn't know anything about organized crime until the 2000s, and that was a result of bumping into a guy by the name of Denny Griffin. Yeah, I'd always assumed that the mob was something from the 30s and 40s, and had long been relegated to the history books. But that's far from true. Denny, would you like to give us a potted history? We can title it The State of the Mob Address.
Yeah, the infamous State of the Mob Address. Well, certainly, of course, organized crime, you can go back to the Sicilian Mafia and so forth. You can go back decades and decades and decades of organized crime. My area that I was interested in was primarily here in America, and it was from a little bit going back to the Capone days in the 20s, but primarily I started out in the 50s and 60s and 70s doing my research and covering those areas, those time frames. And a lot of people, I think, had the impression that organized crime basically was in the, what did Ronald Reagan, the dustbin of history or whatever that term was, and was over with. And that is far from true. That organized crime, like I think any successful business, adapts to conditions. For example, the end of Prohibition could have spelled the end of I mean, these guys, these organized criminals, bootlegging stuff, made millions and millions and millions of dollars and gathered a lot of strength. Now, when Prohibition was repealed, they could have said, we had our run, you know, we're going to go back and start punching a time clock somewhere. Well, they didn't do that. They adapted to the conditions. Okay, if that venue was no longer available to them, they got into other stuff. And I think that's the story today. Not to say that organized crime hasn't been hurt by some of the prosecutions of late, and of course with the RICO, the federal charge RICO statute, they've been damaged, no question about it. Are they as strong as they used to be 50, 60, 70 years ago? Probably not. But they are there. They're into different things now maybe than they were, but they're still out there. If there's money to be made, I suspect you'll find some type of organized crime involvement either in it or trying to get in it.
Vito, I'd like to ask you a philosophical question. Rogue Town very much focuses on the city of Stamford. And looking back, you know, you grew up there. How did Stamford get into the state that it did? Were the officials inherently corrupt and basically welcomed organized crime with open arms? Or was it organized crime that lured the officials into their spider web?
Well, I think, Simon, it's a little bit of both. Because what's unique about our story, and not really that unique, I was going to say that Stamford, Connecticut, had been entrenched with organized crime for at least 20 to 25 years before we tried to start taking some action against it. So it was a little bit of yes on both of those questions, because it was welcomed, and the kickbacks were gigantic to anybody that wanted to be involved in it. See, right on the cover of the book, it says here, when organized crime controls the police department, they control the entire city. And that is so true, because if you have the police department locked up, so to speak, pardon the pun, and you know that you don't have to worry about anything. You have no, when you have no accountability, like I say, you have nothing to worry about, no matter where you're working or what you're doing. So what happened was a lot of the city agencies, public works, fire departments, police departments, so this was entrenched for so long that it was almost impossible, and it took quite a while to knock it out of the system. Anthony Dolan, being a beat writer back then, a Cub reporter, started putting articles in the paper. He wrote about 80 of them total, 75 to 80, and he started banging away with his information about things that were going on. People were getting contracts that didn't deserve to get contracts, city contracts. People were promoted to heads of departments where they supposedly needed a top college education and everything like that. People were being appointed without even a high school degree in some cases. So it went on and on and on, Simon, but it was very lucrative. And, Stamford, don't forget, like the old, I don't know if you're familiar with him, the old George M. Cohan song, 45 Minutes from Broadway, that he sang way back in the early 1900s. That's how far Stamford, Connecticut is from actually being right in New York City. And it's a very rich city. Stamford has always been more well-to-do than most other cities throughout the East Coast. It's a big Fortune 500 mecca for many of the companies that come in, Xerox and all the big companies. And there's a lot of money to be made in Stamford. And organized crime got their hooks into that. And it was welcomed by certain people in the city, and it went from there. It was a mutual admiration society without really love for each other. This was all based on money, like most everything is, Simon.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have Anthony Dolan on the line, although I would have loved to have invited him. A couple of years ago, my wife and I got involved in a child abuse case in Northern California. We contacted the local newspaper and got hold of the reporter that had, covered the story. And we did some back and forth. I got some, decent information. And then suddenly it stopped. And what killed it dead was a comment that she made. You have to understand, we have to live in this city. We can't go up against the police.
Well, I heard that many times, if I can jump in there, Simon.
Sure.
When it first came up in the early 1970s, I was a narcotics cop with my partner, Joe Ligi, and we were making a lot of arrests, but every time we tried to get the real big people, somehow our search warrants produced nothing. They were told in advance, and, you know, we wound up just banging our heads against the wall. Until finally an informant, a street informant that we had arrested on lesser charges, wanted to know if we could talk to the prosecutor about getting his charges reduced or dropped if he told us some real big information. That's when he proceeded to tell us about my own lieutenant, that not only this is not only Stanford that was involved, that my lieutenant who ran the narcotic squad in Fairfield County, so you're dealing with the whole county itself, that had all the power to do whatever he had to, and my sergeant on the police department, on the narcotics squad, a fellow by the name of Duke Morris, who ran all the narcotics activity, again, mostly in Stanford, but also all the way up to Bridgeport, Connecticut. So Larry Hogan, my lieutenant, was the man for organized crime. He had his hooks into organized crime. He knew all the top players, not only in Connecticut, but also in New York City. And Duke Morris ran the drug empire. When Duke Morris died several years later, he was being looked at that time for 6 murders. And Larry Hogan, when he was finally arrested, was indicted for murder himself. So you're dealing with vicious people in a city of about 130,000 people.
Right. And I'm going to go back to my original question. You know, why was Anthony Dolan permitted to write these articles? Because the whole thing could have been hushed up if someone had lent on the, you know, on his editor and, you know, to make it go away.
Good point. Very good point about that. And that may be almost happened. And let me explain to you why. Anthony Dolan is almost the exact same age as me. I think we're just a couple of months apart in age. And he started writing. He came into the Stanford Advocate as a young guy in his early to mid-20s, as I was at the same time. And he started getting the information. Now, when he first started writing the articles, the publisher and different people, not that they were corrupt, they were not corrupt, but they kind of did not, you know, this was stirring up a whole city, a whole city that was a Fortune 500 city. And they were kind of, what they would try to do, Simon, is they would try for his 8-hour work period, they would try to give him other jobs to do. In other words, they would go cover the Girl Scouts selling cookies, take some pictures over there, write a story up, go to the Rotary Club and it's their 100th anniversary, write something about them. And what he would do then is he would stay afterwards for almost another 8 hours, delving into his own stories. Now, what happened, though, again, where it's all about money, they didn't like it at first as his first a couple articles came out. But what happened is once the publisher, the editor, and everybody else found out that the papers were selling out every day, they couldn't make enough papers for the public to read, then it was kind of like, keep going, Anthony, that's very good. They changed their whole perspective on things, and a whole city was glued every day to his stories. What could it be tomorrow? What could it be tomorrow? And, you know, at first they didn't want to stir the pot. Oh, yeah, I don't know. He's stirring the pot. He's going agency to agency. He's taking things against the whole town. Everybody, according to Anthony Dolan, wow, I mean, is he crazy or what? He's taking our whole nice town and blowing it up. But once people realize that it's the truth, and the main thing, Simon, was that all the public, or a good part of the public, start writing him, dropping dimes in phone booths, as they say, giving him information every day. They found a colleague with him. And, you know, one of the things he wrote in our book was, we'll get into, I'm sure, about his relationship with Ronald Reagan, but one of the things he writes at the end of the foreword, he says he always remembers what Ronald Reagan said, evil is powerless if the good are unafraid, which is such a profound statement that he ends the foreword with. Evil is powerless if the good are unafraid. So that's what happened. The editors, publishers, anybody connected to higher-ups didn't want this to start at first. We're against it. They figured, well, you know, we don't want to stop him. He's got all these, like they say in writing terms, I got three or four or five people backing up this statement that I checked with. And so it's legitimate, so to speak. But once they realized what they had on their hand, and once they got a Pulitzer put in their hands, they were very happy people.
I'll bet. Denny, a question for you. Most people, most regular folks, think that an undercover operator is a pretty glamorous position. But in my view, it's far from that. I see it as high stress and very bad for your life expectancy. I can't remember the title of the book. It was The Making of Someone.
Making of Jack Falcone.
That's it. All right. And I believe I was on a program with him. And, you know, he was pretty darn scared most of the time. Undercover life isn't a good one. Vito, clearly you were concerned for your safety at times.
Oh, I was. Getting back for a second to Jack Garcia, who I know and has been on my show as well as everybody's shows, he was the premier man in undercover, working for the FBI at that time. Nobody can match his record. And what I mean by that, everybody has done a great job over the years, whether it's Frank Serpico or whoever it may be. So everybody in their own right did marvelous jobs where each moment of your life you're in chaos, okay? But I can't even imagine for the 20-plus years or whatever Jack did. That it just boggles my mind because I had several years of doing it, a few years, and I was out of my mind. Everything. I had to, see a Christian psychologist. I had to do many, many things with my life just because of the pressures of each day. But that, you know, I just wanted to give, Jack kudos on that because that was absolutely extraordinary. And not only that, he'd be in one side of the country one day and the other side of the country the next day, juggling two totally different types of cases with totally different names. How the heck can you do that, you know? I mean, I infiltrated two mob families up here, and Genovese and the Gambino, and fortunately I, knew all the players, and I didn't have to kind of wonder who's doing this. I know what everybody was doing from being born and raised there.
Right, but it must have been incredibly tough for you. That there's a couple of spots in the book, where ex-friends or friends, that you used to have and suddenly view you as being venomous. And that has to be incredibly hard to deal with. And you can't tell them, look, it's just a game.
Yeah, no, that was probably, Simon, the worst part of that in my life. I mean, I mentioned in the book, I go to a restaurant, Polici's restaurant, and I'm sitting there with a couple mobsters, and I look over, and there's about five or six really good guys from the police department, all that were friends of mine. And just by their looks at me, their sorrowful looks at me, as if to say, wow, after all this time of fighting them, Vito's going over to the other side. The worst, obviously, like I say in the book, is going to my father's barbershop, and him, from cutting hair of a lot of cops, looked at me, and I could see the sadness and the disappointment in his eyes. And wow, that knocked me for a loop. I wanted to just hug him and say, no, Dad, keep your mouth shut. Now, this is a fake thing. But he wouldn't have understood that. He had come over from Italy, and he never would have understood that. So I left with an unbelievable amount of sadness on me from that day. It was horrible. Only my wife knew, and she didn't even know the extent of different things. I kept that. We had five little kids at the time growing up, five children. So I think the best way to explain it, Simon, if I could, is to just quickly say in my business, I have a lot of people that come to me that have lost a child, either in a murder or whatever happened with them. And as one guy said to me one day, I go through my life, but I go through it in a fog. I still work. I still talk to people, but it's kind of like I'm in this big fog thing. And I firmly believe for the time I worked that stuff and had people coming after me and set me up to be murdered, I believe that whole era for me was in a fog. I'm glad it ended. Glad it ended the way it did. And, you just move on in your life.
Okay. A question that I probably already know the answer to, but I think it's worth asking anyway. Was there any point where you considered switching sides? You know, you could see the high life that was available from the crime side, and you know the stress and grief that you were getting as an undercover agent. Did you ever consider, I'm just going to join the bad guys?
No, and here's the reason why. Even before it all came out, as you read in the book, you'll see that there was some of the top drug dealers, the biggest drug dealers in the whole county, that had approached my partner about both of us wanting to pay both of us off a considerable amount of money a week, a month, just to let them be, because we had such a reputation on knocking off people, except for, and they were worried about us getting them, because we didn't know at that time about our bosses that was protecting them. But there was no stopping us from grabbing them on the street and putting them away too. So no, during that time, no. There was never any consideration during the time I worked. In fact, I had, as a young guy in my 20s and 30s, such a hatred for organized crime. Before the show started today, I was just glancing at the news back home in Connecticut, and I see one of the 16 guys that got arrested last summer in a big major bust there, both organized crime and narcotics, was just sentenced to at least 5 years of time in the federal prisons. So that was good to see. I still know all the names and the players, but no, never have I once did that. In fact, I'm the type of guy that talks to my colleagues and say, let them go out and get a job instead of ruining it, quite honestly, Simon, for people that have the same type of last names as me and come from the same heritage, being Italian. I hate that because, especially with a name like Vito Colucci, that's about that's about as exotic as you're going to get as far as organized crime. I can make you really laugh for a minute. I tell a story of all through my growing up in the 50s, early 60s, 1950s, going to school, elementary school. Teachers the kids, of course, would make fun of my name. But the teachers, I never forget, I had a teacher, a man teacher one time, that said to me, as you get older, you don't understand it now, you're 11 or 12, you may want to think of changing your name when you become an adult. And I never forgot that. Now, fast forwarded to now, where, let's say a TV show calls me and the producer's on the other end talking to me, all of a sudden she'll say to me, wow, what a great name, Vito Colucci, that is such a great, great name. And I laugh. I don't go through the story with them, but I just laugh to myself, all of a sudden now I'm in vogue at 65, 66 years old, so.
Denny, I think I put it in the in my review of the book. I knew I was in trouble. There's Vito, and there's someone called Gino.
Yes.
It's just a matter of time before someone knocks on my door.
We have some intriguing names here, don't we?
We do. I looked at the email and I went, it's Denny. Right? I know there's trouble involved here. Vito, if you could do it all again, if you could wind the clock back, would you do it, or would you just say, no, you know, I'm going to find me a real job?
Well, you know, certain things happen in your life that you, by and large, don't have control of. But you look back and you say, hey, it happened, it happened. I probably would do it all over again. Not now, though. What I'm saying is, when you're young, you got this all this energy and this courage that, as you get older, hopefully becomes more wisdom. And you say, get away from me. Now, obviously, as I got in my 30s, 40s, 50s, no way would I get involved in it. But you know what's so funny about it all, Simon, and I probably need a psychologist to help me answer the question. I said to my partner, Joe Ligi, one day, who was with me through all the bulk of this stuff and being threatened himself, I said, Joe, I said, all the things you've done in your life, you've been a police chief, you've done this, you ran, you were part of running a prison system in Arizona, Phoenix area, everything you've done, what did you enjoy the most? And it only took him a second to say, you and me working narcotics, me working narcotics during that time. And I say, Joe, I feel the same way. I say, I don't understand it. It was by far the worst time in my life, financially, family-wise, everything combined, but it was the most exciting part of my life. And it's kind of like, how could that be? You know, I guess I don't know, Simon, but that's what I say. But I would never even entertain the idea as I got older.
Right. Changing the subject almost completely, I want to go back to Anthony Dolan, this cub reporter that, you know, is out there, you know, nipping at people's heels. You helped him, albeit anonymously. When did he realize that you were one of the people helping him?
Oh, not till we started writing a book and I contacted him. He had so many people that worked for him. Now, even to this day, there was a big Rolling Stones article going back into the 80s about Anthony Dolan after he was hired by Reagan and the Pulitzer and everything else, where he talks about the story of Stamford, Connecticut. And he says that he had one guy who he gives a false name to, who I don't even know who it was, that really worked with him almost every day in digging up things, who was a police officer. Okay, I got accused of that back then, and I wasn't. I knew so much, and I would give him anonymous tips, but I would never tell him who I was, nor never met him. And he had a lot of assistance from all the good cops that would call anonymously. Maybe one or two would feel the freedom to tell him their name, and he just had a lot of people that just helped shape what was going to happen. People got tired of that town. People were tired of being at their jobs, let's say in the town hall, of whatever they were doing, and having 15, 20 years on the job and being passed over for a promotion by somebody that had 2 years on the job, of which they knew was the nephew of somebody important in the city hall. See, people got tired of that, Simon, and they didn't want it anymore. And Anthony Dolan rode into town on his white horse, and wound up, his life was threatened, rocks through his car windows, and death notes. He would get pictures at the newspaper of dead bodies. So, I mean, the man went through a torturous thing himself. But he stayed the line, and he went on, and he achieved, you know, great things.
Rocks through windows. Don't I recall in the book you actually tossed a rock?
Well, you have no proof of that. Yes, I guess you do. I say it in the book. Well, you know, I was very fortunate on that because, Simon, see, as you read in the book, there were 7 or 8 police officers that, you know, Dolan didn't mention by name in the articles, but kind of some of the people knew. I knew who each one was. Okay, once I got involved in it, I knew who each one was. But the cop that came up to me at the police department after a shift and, you know, gave me this crazy story about people from New York City that are also working on getting Larry Hogan. They'd like to meet with you and discuss it, and maybe you guys could combine together. Thank God I knew at that time that this guy who I was talking to was one of the seven or eight, albeit maybe down near the end of it. But he was still working for different people, still arranging the junkets to Las Vegas, all things of that nature. And thank God that I did it the way I did. As far as throwing the pretty big rock, I mean, that was stupid on my part. I mean, I was just like, you know, until I got back in my car and got back on the highway, I said, you know, then the sweat started coming, like, oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
That may have sounded funny, but now I really, really opened up myself. But then again, they were going to kill me whether I threw a rock or not. Didn't throw a rock, so I might as well have some fun with it. But horrible times. And Denny,
okay.
I was so proud of Denny taking over writing the book, because with his track record and, you know, the Culotta book and the Surviving the Mob, which was the one right before my book and everything, he believed in it. And we're seeing the results now. And the way he put it together, the people just love it. I get comments all the time. So, you know, definitely kudos to my partner over there.
Oh, Denny is the best. But before we move on, why don't you tell us the rock story? All right, you're invited to a meeting.
Yes. In other words, what happened was outside the police department, this fellow by the name of Joe, who was one of the seven or eight people that were linked to organized crime. This fellow Joe was the one in the book, as people read the book, that during our shifts, when we're getting ready to go on the road, where our lockers getting ready with our gun belts and everything else, would walk up and down the aisle of the lockers and say, hey, look, we got a junket to Las Vegas. And they would name the organized crime figure. Anybody who wants to go, come on, let's get this together. And one guy would maybe yell from a locker, I don't have the money to do that. No, don't worry about that. The plane is free. The room is free. You just need to show that you're going to bring X amount of money to gamble, and everything else is taken care of. Now, he's the same guy then that approaches me afterwards. And, you know, not that same day, but, you know, several days later, outside the police department as we're leaving. And, you know, he made it like he got word. He was a more senior man on the job than I was, so he had a lot more years on the job than I did. And, you know, it would have been believable if I didn't know that all the stuff he's already did. And he said, meet these people in Port Chester, New York. They want to talk to you, and they want to help you, and you can help them. And putting Larry Hogan away, their top people. Now, that would seem, you know, pretty legitimate, you know, unless you knew something about the guy that's telling you the story. So what I did is we were supposed to meet, I believe, on a Thursday. I forgot what it was. But the day before, I took a ride there. And I took a ride, same exact time we were going to meet. And I realized that the back parking lot, there was a big grass and trees that went up on a hill behind where cars were parked. So I located where that street was, got out of my vehicle, and I looked and I said, wow, I can see the whole back parking lot from this. And so the next day I got there early, the day that we were supposed to meet, actually, I got there early, and I looked from my vantage point. It was getting dark, so I had good cover with the trees and everything else. Nobody can see me. And I can see my boss's car, Larry Hogan, sitting there in the parking lot with a guy, Dave the Turk, who was a known organized crime and a little bit of everything type of guy, drugs, everything else, sitting in the passenger seat with Larry. And I said, oh, my God, this is a setup. You know, this is a setup. I felt they were going to just, you know, and they were near the back door where you would have to go. No doubt in my mind they were going to, you know, no reason why they would be there waiting. They're waiting for me. They would have grabbed me, threw me in the trunk or the back seat, and that would have been the end of it, you know? And that's that story.
So, in retribution, you know, you decided to just hurl a rock through the...
I just, in my sweat and everything, in my anger, I guess in summing it up now, probably this unbelievable anger that was in me. I saw a good size, a really good size rock that I could pick up with one hand that kind of filled my hand. And, it, you know, all it was a downhill throw to the back windows, and the back windows back at that time in the 70s were, you know, a lot bigger and wider than they are now. And I just happened to hit the, you know, the on a part of the side of the glass, and it exploded. And as I ran to my car, which I really ran quickly, I, because here I'm thinking they're going to get out of the car with guns, and they're not going to know where the heck it came from, because all it was a rock that went through their back window. They're not going to look up or look around. They're going to look all over the place. And I took off. By the time I got to my car, that was hidden in another street, neighboring street, and I jumped in and took off for the highway. Then all of a sudden it changed from that to fear. From the elation to fear, it happened very quickly, Simon. You know, I say in the book that I wasn't a tough guy then, and I'm not a tough guy now. So I just tried to do my stuff that through in those eras and getting things accomplished, and it was a long haul. And now many years later, you know, Denny and the publisher, and, you know, I asked Denny to do the book, and it's very strange. You know, Denny just said to me, now, you know, I didn't have to build up on it. Denny only answered me by saying, do you have a car with a three-body trunk? And I said, yeah. He says, all right, I'll write your book. I couldn't figure it out to this day. Maybe on the national radio he could answer that. I don't know what that meant. Do I have a car with a three-body trunk? So.
It's a side joke, you know.
Denny, that rock story, that must have brought a smile to your face.
Denny, that's for you.
Oh yeah, I really enjoyed the rock story. I had an image, you know, visual in my head. I could see Vito doing that. I mean, it was really quite a story, and it was. I could understand him wanting to do it because he had to be frustrated with all the, for years, working on this stuff and not knowing who you could share your information with, and nothing ever seemed to get done. And it looked like probably almost an impossible situation to be in. So you had to be very frustrating. And then knowing these guys are setting you up what appeared to be probably for a hit. But it also was humorous at the same time. So, yeah, it was really an enjoyable a part of the book.
Yeah, I mean, an incredibly serious situation. And there's little doubt that, you know, had Vito gone to the meeting, we wouldn't be talking to him today.
Exactly.
Right. He'd be wearing, you know, lead boots somewhere. But you know, the idea of, you know, wreaking revenge by hurling a rock through the back of the window, I mean, it made me laugh, and you know, laugh in a good way.
Yeah, it was kind of like, well, you son of a bees, when I saw them, and I was just going to take off, and I saw it, and I picked it up, and I threw it, I said, yes, and I ran and ran and ran. So, but, you know, it's amazing. You asked Denny how he felt about, you know, that story. But it's amazing as a writer what he's done, that he would take all the stories and visualize them. And here I was at the scene, you know, I'm at these places, but Denny would visualize them and just write them so magnificently that the book has become a really good seller, and we're having fun with it, and much of that is due with Denny Griffith. I was his 13th, lucky, I was his 13th, lucky 13th book.
Yeah, I've known Denny for a few years, and he is one damn fine writer. Yeah, you can quote me on that, Denny.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
All right.
You know, Simon, maybe it's an appropriate spot. I don't think we mentioned this already, but in fact, in about 2 hours, Vito and I are going to be meeting in here in Vegas with another writer, a lady named Morgan St. James, and the three of us are going to work on the sequel to Rogue Count. We're going to have an organizational meeting at 1 p.m. local Vegas time, and the three of us are going to set up our plan and start writing the sequel to Rogue Count.
Oh, I can't wait. I was going to ask that question, actually. So, I have to admit, I was incredulous over how you were unmasked. It was an unfortunate set of circumstances, yet I was also incredulous as to the lack of planning, the lack of forethought. You know, with Stanford being so corrupt, keeping you on the regular payroll seems like a pretty dumb idea.
Well, yeah, it was. In retrospect, it was. It should have been done a different way. I had no idea, obviously, you know, of what was going on paycheck-wise. But back then, the payroll department was housed in a old brick building that was, like, I don't know how many years old, but they've been in Stanford. And it was kind of the in-between building from the town hall, the old town hall, to when they built the new government center. This was kind of like an era in between that where they used this for some police department activities, and one of which was the payroll division, which wasn't a very big division. There's literally only a couple people there. An old printing process, I guess, of how they did the checks back then, I don't really know. But, you know, it was really a matter of just a couple people that even worked there. And even in saying that, Simon, it wasn't a place where people were going to just, you know, look at every single check. They were just concerned about the way it was back then. They would pick a check up and put it in an envelope, you know, with a see-through name in it, and just somebody would get it over to the police department. So it wasn't like somebody, as according to the chief, somebody that was going to study all these checks. It just happened to pop up in front of them, and the person didn't know me at that time until they heard one of their relatives talking about it at a cookout, a fairly big cookout. And, you know, I mean, again, you know, it's not like Joe Smith, Bob Brown, Tom Jones. It was Vito Colucci, a much easier name to recognize, truthfully. And when they heard all the made men and all the gangsters talk about, oh, yeah, that Colucci, man, you quit the police department and this and that, and boy, you know, what are we going to do about Larry Hogan? And a lady finally said, you talking about Vito Colucci? Yeah, she says, I still do his checks. I still do, you know, do his checks. So they told her to be sure when she went in on Monday, just check and see. And, you know, it was. But, you know, like it says in a lot of the editorials and the things after that, it came at a time where so much of my work was done, you know, as far as, you know, the FBI part of it and things of that nature. So,
right.
You know, it could have, hey, They could have set me up. They could have set me up at that poker game that I went and let me come in the door and get rid of me instead of the guy that was running the poker game saying, get the hell out of here and never come back here again. We don't want to see you again, when he knew that I was still on the police department. They could have let me in, and they could have had a lot of people right there at that time. So thank God on that, too.
Right. I mean, you know, when I read the story, I go, wow, you are one lucky guy. You know, it didn't take much to rile up the organized crime folks then, and I doubt it does take much to rile them up now. You know,
right.
We're talking about an ex-Vito Colucci.
That's right. Well, you know, Simon, you say lucky. I there is an element of luck, of course, but I believe more firmly as a Christian man that God was really watching out for me. As you know, you got the shootout in there, and then you got all these different things going on. That's why a lot of times nowadays, and Denny can tell you, like if I'm with Denny or other people, I tend to kid around a lot, okay? And I probably think that's so changed from when I was younger, probably because after what I've gone through, I'm so at peace with my life now that I have a tendency to laugh and crack a joke or say something funny or something like that because, you know, I really feel I've been blessed. God watched over me then. He's watching over me now. And I just feel so, you know, tranquil about it that, you know, hey, I'm still standing.
Okay, this story really all started with the appointment of the new chief of police. You know, he came into office with his brand new broom. Yeah, he was going to sweep everything clean. But that seemed to change over time. You saw that, and it's certainly reflected in the book. What went wrong?
Well, when I went back to Connecticut on one of my last trips, and I spoke at a big function, and I was telling the audience about the change I saw in Chief Victor Chizankis. Another person raised their hand during question time, and he was a city official, an honest city official from back then. And he said, "You know, Vito, I can verify what you're saying. I saw a total change in him. It was like he was had some mental illness going on. He got so what I feel that happened, Simon." First of all, he did a lot of great things for the city. Everything he promised me, he did for me after the assignment was over. But then as he kept wanting me to do the assignment, I started to see a change in him, an obsession with organized crime, where he just wanted to wanted more and more and more, and he wanted to be kept to himself, to use, so I guess he could get the kudos or whatever it was. And I really was a little bit afraid of him at the end, my last couple meetings with him, and he died, you know, very, very young of a heart attack. But, you know, you can almost see it coming. He was obsessed with organized crime, and I think that was his demise there.
I'll tell you what, folks. Why don't we have absolutely shameless commercial break? Is there a website for Rogue Town, and where can people buy this delightful book?
Well, Denny, take that over, Denny.
Yes, there's probably the best place for online is Amazon. They have the best deals on it, and certain orders get free shipping and so on and so forth. So it's up Rogue Town, ROGUE. TOWN, Vito Colucci and Dennis Griffin on Amazon. I'd say it's the best online bet. Some bookstores, depending on the location, Barnes and Nobles, are stocking it on the shelves. It can also be ordered, if they don't have it in stock, that you can order it through any Barnes and Noble store because it is in their system. And they would have the book sent in and then call the customer when it arrives, and you can come pick it up. So I would say either of those are the best choices. Amazon or go to your local Barnes & Noble. If they don't have the book physically there, they will get a copy for you. That we're going to start in the next week or two, you can also order through Houdini Publishing. That's Houdini, just like the magician, publishing.com. And we are going to be autographing books for their inventory at the publisher's warehouse. So if you order from the publisher directly, Houdini Publishing, you'll be able to get a signed copy of the book at no additional charge. So that will be in the next week or two. We're going to get that set up.
How come I didn't get a signed edition?
Well, we figure what we're going to do is that it will entice you to bring your book out to Vegas on a little mini vacation, and we'll sign it for you.
There you go. How splendid.
And I'll tell you what, if you do that, let us know when you're going to get in, and Vito and I will show up driving our three-bodied trunk car and pick you up.
I know this is just curiosity, Simon, but how tall and how much do you weigh? And I'm just, believe me, it has nothing to do with the other thing. I'm just kind of curious.
I'm 5'7", 148 pounds.
Oh, that's not going to count. That'll only be counted as, that's very good. We can maybe get 2.5 other people in there.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Yeah, two adults and a midget, right?
We're almost at the end here, but I wanted to ask about your new book, your follow-up. Can you share anything about what it's going to be about?
Sure. Well, here's what I can share. Since we did Rogue Town, since the day it came out, and just because of how popular, let's say, it became, I began getting almost daily, Simon, material on not only cases we talked about in the book, but relatives. We talk about Larry Hogan. I've gotten some of his closest relatives have contacted me with information. Information on other mounds of information has been dropped in my lap about other cases during that era. But see, also what we're going to do on this book, it's going to be really broken up into several sections. One of the sections will be a continuing talk about Rogue Town, the original, and new information to show the public. Then it will go from there. There'll be many things through the 80s and even into the early 1990s about Stamford, Connecticut, because it did not end there completely. As one generation of a lot of people were indicted and resigned and left, other new people came in. There was compromised murder things going on. There was other stuff which we can't talk about at this stage, but it's going to be a continuation. It'll probably bring us up to about 1990 on it now.
I can't wait. And I know this is a silly question. When are you planning on publishing this? Do I have to wait like 10 years?
No, I mean, we're hoping if it all goes right. I guess a lot of that will be talked about today at our meeting a couple hours from now. But I would love to see it out, if possible, next January or February, kind of like the first book, if we can. I've become more aware of how to do this. Denny always has been. And now we got Morgan on top of it all, who's a great, great writer herself. And I think I have so much of the story and the material here already that I don't think it'll take a long, long time. And of course, we want to do it right, and we're not going to rush it because we're having a lot of fun with this one right now.
Right. Denny, from a publishing point of view, are you pretty happy with the response you're getting to Rogue Town?
Very happy.
Very happy.
Very happy, Mr. Simon. It really couldn't be going much better. Very, very well received, and people already, almost like the first review, for example, on Amazon, or one of the first reviews was, when is the rest of the story coming out? You know what I mean? So there was almost, we hadn't written this with the idea of a sequel. That wasn't part of the plan, but like Vito said, he keeps getting more and more information, stuff that was unknown to him from some of the things that were addressed in Rogue Town, and information about a whole bunch of stuff that wasn't that he wasn't aware of at all with other things that have happened in Stamford during and since the era covered in Rogue Town. So it's really been fabulous, and like he said, we're getting people, relatives of some of the people who were mentioned in the first book, coming forward with insights and information that was unknown before. So, and I believe if you can offer the public new and fresh information, you're doing a service to them, because nobody wants to just hear a rehash of the same stuff over and over. When you can come up with, if you will, groundbreaking information, I think that's a great thing.
Oh, and I'm in total agreement. Vito, are you excited about Rogue Town version 2?
Very excited. Again, there was no thought in my mind, like Denny just said, about a Rogue Town 2. But, we truthfully have, and Denny can tell you, we have people that went on to be fire chiefs in Stamford, people that were involved in head people in the state police that have told stories about how their younger sister was, put on drugs, so to speak, by Duke Morris, and how she died of a drug overdose. I mean, these are all things that are after the book. I mean, there's mounds of stuff, as well as then, of course, the one part of the book is just going to be a continuation of Rogue Town 1, but the bulk of the book, I'd say the other three quarters, is going to be totally all new cases, all new environment, all new reporter that took over for 15 years after Anthony Dolan left. That continued. He was a top crime reporter, many awards himself, and you know, wrote magnificent stories. I just met with him on my trip back to Connecticut. And we, you know, he's given me all the clippings. Like Denny can tell you, we had mounds of newspaper clippings this time around, and we'll have, if not, probably a little bit more this time. So it's going to be put together well, you know, as only Denny can, and Morgan, of course, too. She's going to be so key on this project that it's like I feel like a kid in a true crime candy store. You know, I want the guy over there with the pinstripe suit, and I want the lady over there. That's alluring and captivating to write my book.
But the name Morgan doesn't really smack of having a mob connection.
Well, St. James, though, you see? St. James. That has a little bit of a...
Hi, Simon, I don't want to be rude, but I know you're running out of time. I just wanted to mention one other thing, if I may.
Sure.
If anybody, any of your listeners are... interested in organized crime, and I'm assuming if they listen to the show, they might be. The first annual MobCon is going to be this September 7th and 8th in Las Vegas at the Palace Station Hotel and Casino. And Vito and I are both participating in MobCon. There are going to be several former mobsters and several former law enforcement people, some people from the entertainment business. A lot of stuff about the movie Casino, and it's going to be, again, September 7th and 8th, and if anyone is interested, the website is www.mob-con.net, mob-con.net, and you can get the list of the speakers and presenters and ticket information and the whole thing at that website.
Let me guess. Is my good friend Andrew DiDonato involved in this?
He just happens to be. And your other good friend Frank Collada is involved in it, and several more.
It was just a wild guess.
Well, very, very good one. Oh, and by the way, we just entered into an agreement. In fact, it was Thursday morning with the mob attraction at the located at the Tropicana Hotel and Casino in Vegas. They are going to be the key sponsor of MobCon 2013, and there's going to be a lot of access to their exhibit and so forth. So there's going to be a lot of stuff. If you're an organized crime enthusiast, you'll be able to see and hear an awful lot at this convention.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure out how on earth I got hooked up with you, Denny.
just remember, that was one of your luckier days.
His wife says the same thing, Simon. I say, Bear, don't bother me with that. I have no idea. I have no idea how you got hooked up with him.
We are basically flat out of time, but I really want to thank the both of you for taking time to talk with this, you know, little guy. Yeah, I'm not a mobster. And I really think that Rogue Town is a fabulous book. I mean, the pair of you have done a wonderful, wonderful job. You know, Denny, I know you're a great writer, and I thought the pinnacle was surviving the mob, but... you've surpassed it with Rogue Town.
Oh, thank you, Simon.
And with that, I will bid you both adieu, but I do hope you'll keep me in the loop. And I'm sure that at some point we will talk again.
Well, thank you very much for having us, Simon, and someday we're going to lure you out here to Vegas.
I can't wait.
You and the Janster.
Right.
Simon, it was a lot of fun to do your show, and great questions, and thank you very much for having us on.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day in the wilds of Las Vegas. Until next time, I'm going to say goodbye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Everybody.
Bye.